All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
In many ways, religion was the very foundation of social movement and advocacy in the world. It's such a dynamic conversation when we're talking about parts of religions that we have inherited, whether that's the values, the wisdom, the morals, or the day-to-day practices, right? Or other concepts of the first gen, things that we also have redefined from what we've been taught or told. I have my beautiful friend Simi here. We're gonna have a discussion around religion and how she defines that within her own day-to-day and what are some points of contention.
Basically, to sum that up, is like, how can you be both Latina and Muslim? You know, that doesn't exist. And the truth of the matter is that, like, it does exist, and it's very common, but it's not dominant culture, right? And so certainly there's so much to be said about the way that we consume dominant culture and ultimately how that even affects the way that we feel somewhat supported in being able to articulate all the identities that we possess.
On the season of The Labyrinth of the First Gen, we will explore a conversation about what we carry with us and what we redefine. We are pioneers just by simply existing.
My name is Simi Chowdhury, and I am currently based in Ames, Iowa. I am a writer and an English professor. I'm completing my master's in fine arts with a focus on creative writing and environment. So I am a writer, and I have previously worked as a public servant, a community organizer. I recently sort of pivoted into this world where I'm focusing more fully on writing. And my big project right now is working on my memoir.
When you hear the words first generation, what comes up for you and your experience as a writer and as an advocate? What comes to mind?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind when you originally asked the question of really trailblazers in the sense that we are the first, we are the pioneers, we are the first ones doing whatever it is that we're doing, wherever we're doing it. That's not at all to reduce at, like, even in the least bit, the generation before us, but specifically doing what we're doing and where we're doing it. I think about that trailblazing and the pioneering, which allows us to ultimately shine in our own light and in our own terms.
So Simi talked about her culture, race, and ethnicity, and how that experience of where she is from ties into her day-to-day and the work that she's currently doing writing her memoir.
I was born and raised in Venezuela. My family lived there for a quarter of a century. We moved to the U.S. right around the time that I had turned 10 years old. My parents are originally from Pakistan. So essentially what all of that means is that I identify as a South Asian, Latina, Muslim American. And these are all identities that I lean in on quite heavily in my journey as becoming an adult in the United States of America. I've learned and taken on a lot more responsibility in what it looks like to be American, quote unquote. You know, And what it means to have U.S. citizenship, which certainly has granted me a whole number of opportunities that I wouldn't have gotten unless I had gotten naturalized. And, you know, that is a part, that's a part of the equation, but certainly as I identify both as South Asian and Latina, I'm always seeking opportunities that allow me to celebrate those aspects of who I am. So, you know, as a Venezuelan, you know, unfortunately, given the current situation, the political climate, if you will, in Venezuela, doesn't really allow me to travel back and forth in the way that I would really like to. And that's a very hard thing for me to grapple with, because it's such a, it's been such an instrumental component of my family history.
However, despite the fact that Simi cannot travel to Venezuela because of the social political situation currently, she has taken other opportunities to really connect to her roots in the Latin American region.
So, you know, I've lived in Colombia, I've lived in Costa Rica, I travel to Latin America as much as I can. So that's, you know, it's a significant part of me. And also, since I lived in Chicago for the majority of my time in the United States, I've also sought out building within communities that reflect my ethnic background. So the other part of me is Pakistani. And so I've had the blessing since I was a child that I would go to Pakistan pretty much every 2 to 3 years. In fact, the most recent trip that I took to Pakistan was in December of 2022. So I recently came back from my trip there. And I am extremely grateful. We still have a considerable amount of our family, that's extended family, that's in Pakistan. And whenever I go, I try to, especially in the last few trips, try to go to places that allow me to get a better understanding of the breadth of the history of a country that's really just 75 years old.
I have a memory of us, and I remember in Colombia, we lived in Colombia together. There was a time I visited, I think, Hayes and you in Bogota, and you took me to, I don't know if it was Eid. I don't think so. But you took me to a mosque there.
I did, yeah. And yes. It was Eid.
Yes, right. I remember. And I think for me, it was very eye-opening because I didn't know that there were Muslims in Latin America, right? So to be able to like go with my friends, see that they were, but there's assumptions around like what NeXT represents, what their faith is, how do they celebrate, and also how in interactions with each other, we're able to disassociate or completely redefine our understanding of the world.
No, that was a special memory, and I'm so glad that it's so timely. You know, we're just about 11 days away from Eid, marking the end of Ramadan, and I do remember that because it just so happened that I was going on a run in the neighborhood that I lived in Bogota, and I saw this home where I could see women that were wearing hijabs. And I was just curious because I was like, okay, it's probably just a home. But I walked up closer to it and I came to see that it was like a home that was converted into a small little mosque. So I was so glad to come across that space because ultimately it ended up being somewhat of a watering well for me during Ramadan as I was having Ramadan in Bogota and ultimately could go to Eid, like, you know, with you. And that's a very common theme, both in, you know, I think I've seen it almost in every place that I visited, that unless it's like a Muslim majority country, there's a lot of times that like a home or a church or something that's like a more residential building will then be converted into a mosque. So that was great to see that.
Yeah, and that's very interesting that you say that because I think of like the idea of like faith and I can't like speak for the Muslim religion, right? But also like there's so many interconnections in faith as well when we're thinking about common values and to see how buildings could be turned in to like from a church to a mosque and be a sacred space for a different group of people. I think that is amazing.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I was just 2 weekends ago, I was in the Twin Cities, so I was in Minneapolis. And I don't know if you know this, but there's like a huge Somali community in the Twin Cities, which is a really beautiful thing. But it was so funny because we went to this Somali restaurant to break our fast. And we became friends with a local who is also a Somali immigrant. And she's been living in Minneapolis for a while. She also came here when she was 10 years old. And she pointed out like one bar that was actually right next to the Somali restaurant that we were eating that got converted into a neighborhood mosque. And then she also referenced this other sort of bar, like, I don't know, it was also a bar that wasn't in the same exact neighborhood, but it was also converted into like a local community-owned, community-frequented mosque. So I thought that was really interesting.
What are some ways in which your identity has really bridged your experience in terms of like, you know, the human experience, being able to connect with people? And what are some points of blockage where people are trying to put you in one box?
It's definitely some of the themes that I grapple with as I'm writing my memoir right now. And I do find that once we come to the United States, unfortunately, we enter into like a pretty reductive society that works off of labels, works off of boxes that are checked because they've been approved by the census, you know, categories that have been predominantly created within sort of a white supremacist mindset. And so what ends up happening, we always have to enter reducing our full selves. Like, it's like I really truly have multifaceted identities. We have multiple components of who we are. You know, when I started to get more vocal about how I really do feel as someone who was Venezuelan in nationality and then went through the 5-year process of becoming a U.S. American citizen, more and more I felt like it's important to share that story. It's important to talk about how we're both Latina and we're Muslim and we're Pakistani. And I found that certainly, you know, this is a little bit dated, but when I remember doing like an interview with Univision once, and the comments were just like, how is it possible, you know, como es posible que puede ser like musulmana y Latina, like eso no existe. Like, basically, to sum that up, is like, how can you be both Latina and Muslim? You know, that doesn't exist. And the truth of the matter is that like it does exist, and it's very common, but it's not dominant culture, right? And so certainly there's so much to be said about the way that we consume dominant culture and ultimately how that even affects the way that we feel somewhat supported in being able to articulate all the identities that we possess. Almost from the very beginning, like, I knew I was different, right? My parents were both very much practicing Muslims while they were living in Latin America, in Venezuela. You know, we had friends that pretty much knew everything about like halal, zabiha meat. They knew my dad is an observant of the 5 daily prayers, that he fasts. Like, we were very much Venezuelan, but we were also very much like Muslims in Venezuela, you know? My dad was, you know, had a very strict like no alcohol policy, and all of his friends were super respectful of that. And I feel as though that certainly was the fact that we were in a predominantly Roman Catholic country. I mean, people who, even if they don't come from the same faith, people of faith recognize people of faith. So there's still like a foundation of mutual respect and appreciation that we always felt and encountered wherever we went.
Simi talked about her own journey to her faith and her relationship to it today.
My journey has certainly been one in which, like, certainly when I was born and raised, I was raised with like the main principles of Islam and the main responsibilities, the rituals. Certainly, like, you know, when you get to be in this post-pubescent age, there's a place that one can get into where you're just kind of in autopilot. You don't really question why you do what you do. You're just like, this is what I was told to do, so that's what I do. And I was pretty comfortable there for a while. It was really only until college that I had this opportunity that was offered by what was once called the Zaytuna Institute, and now they're the Zaytuna College, and they're the only 4-year accredited Muslim university in the United States of America. So they're based out of Berkeley, California. So in 2008, the Zaytuna Institute had publicized this summer intensive Arabic program. And I was like, all right, I'm intrigued. I'm really excited. So I went for it. And the whole idea was that during this summer period, during a 10-week span, you would be fully immersed in what's called Fusha, or traditional Arabic. It's the Arabic that the Quran was revealed in. Mm-hmm. So it's the most traditional form of Arabic. What I didn't know going into that program is that while I was going to be learning Arabic, I was also going to be learning a lot, and I was going to be exposed for the first time to Sufism, which is sort of the mystic branch of Islam. I don't want to call it a branch, and in the sense that I don't want to misrepresent the faith that this is like an offshoot, because that's absolutely not the case. But what Sufism, from my understanding, really focuses on is the spiritual component of the faith. Really with this sort of baseline understanding that God is a merciful God. Every single thing we do, we start by saying, in the name of God, the most merciful, the most gracious. What does that really mean? And what that did is that it separates you from all of the like sort of ritual, kind of more specific practices, in the sense that you're not focusing just on like, this is what you do, this is what you don't do, this is halal, this is haram. It's more about like, why don't we take a step back and really think about what is our relationship with God? What was the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, relationship with God? Like, what does it look like when you approach this faith as a human being? That's where it all begins. And for me, being with scholars, I mean, the thing about Sufis is like, they'll never say that they're a Sufi. And you can tell when someone is entering a space and speaking on Islam with a Sufi perspective, because it's far less about, you know, the orthodox kind of, again, the black and whiteness of faith, and it's far more about the gray. Because the truth about the human lived experience is that we work and live and operate in the gray. And so when I was seeing these sort of like quotes of Rumi, like, you know, come everyone, ours is not a caravan of despair, and, you know, come 1,000 times. It like touched a part of my soul. I mean, I was like 18, 19 years old at the time. I had no idea that this faith that I had called my own since I was born is a faith that also deals so heavily with the human being at a very rudimentary level. And it was just so profound for me. And honestly, for me, it was an opportunity to recommit to the faith, because now I understood it from a whole other perspective that was so much more relatable. You know, it wasn't like, this is the Quran and it's unattainable and it's unreachable, and you just read it so that you can finish it and then you have a celebration. It's like, no, this is the Quran. This is a dictionary. You can translate it yourself. You are now empowered to do that on your own. You can also understand the context under which this particular chapter was revealed. What was happening in the Prophet's life when this chapter was revealed? What was going on with people in the community when God decided to reveal this part of the Quran, you know? And so it's like, now there's so many more layers. There's all these different doors that are opening up for me in the faith that I already identify with. That was just, it was like a taking a breath of fresh air, you know? And that journey for me is a journey that'll be with me until I die. You know, we talk about this within the tradition, is that there's no one that's better than the other because we're all seekers.
We're going to take a quick pause and continue the conversation when we return. The Labyrinth of the First Gen would like to announce a call to action. We hope that you are currently enjoying the show, and we want to hear feedback from you. So if you are listening on this show on any of iTunes platform, Spotify, as well as Google Podcasts, please rate the show. Let us know what you think. And as they say, sharing is caring. So share this episode with a friend.
And we are back. This is the Labyrinth of the First Gen.
Current generations such as Gen Z and millennials are the least likely to be religiously affiliated or associated. In a Pew Research study, it was found that Gen Z is the nation's least religious generation, with about a third having no religion. And for millennials, it was pretty close to that of Gen Z as well, as compared to 23% for Generation X, 17% for baby boomers, and 11% for the silent generation. In the question around the stats that Gen Z as well as millennials are not as practicing religion as often as the previous generations, Simi gave her perspective on what she thinks is the cause of this.
I think it's a reaction to the way that faith has been propagated for so long. And I think it's also an invitation for us individually to say, hey, if this is a way that it's been fed to me, what if I were to take a step back and were to analyze this and utilize my own intellect, if you will, to be able to see what about this actually does resonate? Because I think that at our core, I believe, don't quote me, if I believe this is from David Foster Wallace, who said that like all beings are meant to worship. We all just pick in different things to worship.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So if someone were to come up to me and be like, oh, I don't worship, it's like, okay, maybe you don't worship what I worship, but you definitely worship something.
I definitely agree. And I think it's so powerful when you have experience where you grew up in a household, because I grew up Catholic. And, you know, what was like preached to me, like if I was in the service, I would ask a question, right? Around why something was this way or that way. It's like, you don't ask questions. You just come to church and that is it, right? But like having a moment or experience where you're in a situation where people are encouraging you to question and saying like, this is a part of our faith, and this is what you can do, right? Almost like that permission piece is really important as well. I think that's like a journey that I'm still like going on, but thinking about how our relationship to faith, as you said, today people assume that it's many things and they don't have the experience or in many ways know what that is, because they're not really thought of or given the permission to explore that on their own and what that means for them too.
And it's an evolution, right? Like it's like we can constantly be evolving in our journey as we're seeking this relationship. Ultimately, for me, like the end game is closeness to the Almighty, you know? And I definitely see what you're saying around the piece of not allowed to ask questions. And what was a game changer for me that summer was like, ask questions, you know, and actually you'll be able to answer them yourself. Trust that there'll be a point where you will get to there, where you can answer those questions. And all of the questions that you're asking, like truly the answer lives within you.
Yes.
I mean, this is the thing about the human being. We were born and given intellect. We just have to use it.
You spoke a lot about evolving, right? So having an experience where you are, you know, realizing that you have the ability to like question things, you have a ability to build your own relationship around your faith. And I want to ask about maybe there's like cultural experiences that you continue to carry on from your upbringing, or what are some things that have changed since then?
I'm doing this MFA program right now, and there's nobody else in my cohort. Our cohort is 8 people that is Muslim. And I was like, that's okay. I love hosting iftar dinners. So last night, and I know my mom loves hosting iftar dinners as well, you know? So last night I threw down, I had a full on iftar dinner. Usually the way that iftar dinners typically work is that there's an initial sort of like small meal that you break your fast on. And within the culture that I grew up in, it was predominantly like a fruit salad or what's called a fruit chaat. So it's like fruit with some spices and orange juice, some samosas and some dates. So I, you know, kind of kicked it off with that and then went into like, then after that, usually people will break for prayer. And then after prayer, we'll come back and have a dinner. And so I like took the opportunity to share what the call to prayer is. The call to prayer marks that it's time to break your fast. So, you know, I had like the speaker on anyway. So I just played the call to prayer because I was like, it's an opportunity for me to teach about my tradition. You know what I mean? So I did that. And then we talked about like the value of breaking your fast with a date, because the date is a prophetic food. The date carries a lot of nutrients that really offer your body what it needs when you've been sort of like you haven't been fasting all day or you're going to be fasting. It's just like packed food item as well. So it, even if you just had like 1 or 2 dates, you feel it like pretty immediately. So in that way, like that's why people break their fast with it, because you're not supposed to eat immediately. You haven't been eating for a while. So it's sort of like preparing your stomach to eat, you know. I wear shalwar kameez, which is traditional clothing in Pakistan. As I said, I recently came back from Pakistan, so I had a cute little outfit that I could wear from the motherland. And yeah, like for me, I'm just like, this is a great opportunity for me to share what I grew up with, a tradition that I really value. The way I choose to practice the fast is that from around like 5:30 a.m., right when the morning prayer comes in, till the late evening prayer of Maghrib, which these days is around 7:45, we don't eat anything, we don't drink anything. And that's how I practice it. Mm-hmm. Everyone is at a different place in their faith. Some people go even further. You know, I know that for a fact, and that's an aspirational goal. I mean, ultimately, again, the end goal is to get closer to God. And for some people, they're like, I just stop doing this one thing that I really want to shake this bad habit. And I feel as though Ramadan is a great opportunity for me to do that. It could be anything. It could be, you know, like if they are someone who has Coca-Cola every day, like they don't want to have Coke every day, right? And so again, the month is really an opportunity to be self-introspective and reflective. And, you know, because you don't have food, less distracted to focus on what really matters. So I took this as an opportunity to share this with my classmates, with my friends. This is a community that I'm a part of, and it's a huge part of who I am. So I feel the need to share it with them.
Something that comes up for me, there's so much beauty in teaching people, right? Like I just learned so much from you right now. But I also think about moments where it becomes exhausting or tiring. And is there a way to, I guess, identify like the moments when you're in the space to be able to teach others and relate to others? And then there's also moments where it's just like, I don't want to tell you, you know, what this represents. Like, I don't have to.
Oh my gosh. I need a stretch to answer that question. The struggle is real. No, I mean, this is so real because earlier this year, actually, I had applied for a very nominal grant that was available to students in my department. And it's basically, I'm trying to do work around resurrecting the stories of partition. Mm-hmm. And I'm starting off with people in my family. I have one great aunt that's living right now who was 12 years old when the partition took place. And I'm really trying to capture an oral story and let that be like sort of a catalyst to resurrecting more stories. Because I know there's so much there. And I know other people have done this too. And I just like, I'm looking to sort of create more inroads in this particular world. So, you know, it was a research grant, and obviously a big portion of what I would do with this is research. And, you know, I didn't get the funding, but the feedback letter as to why I didn't get the funding, the second line reads that this individual has never heard of the 1947 partition of India. And by a very quick, less than a minute Google search, you can find out that the 1947 partition of India is the bloodiest partition that's ever been recorded in history. And I ultimately called a meeting with, you know, whomever, the higher ups, whoever I could, not because I was upset that I didn't get this funding, but I was upset that that was written on a piece of paper that was then circulated electronically, because I'm like, y'all can't be doing stuff like this. You know what I mean? Like, it's just not okay. What I mean by being an advocate, even when you're not necessarily in a role that is directly related to advocacy. This is just one example of that. But man, after that meeting, I was fighting back tears. You know, this is what erasure looks like. This is what it looks like when you're in a meeting where you're the only brown person and there's people that are literally looking at you dead straight in the eyes. And they're telling us, you need to do the work of telling us what happened to your people. And I'm like, you have Google. You have a library right there. You know, you have access to resources. You are the most, you're in the position of authority in this situation. So you have access to more resources than I even have. How are you going to sit here and look at me and say that you're not extremely apologetic that this was written in a feedback letter, you know? But my point in sharing that is that that was a real moment for me. I felt emotionally exhausted after it. I felt heartbroken. You know, it's so part of the whole reason why I'm doing what I'm doing, because that's like, you know, we need to tell our stories, because if we don't, other people are going to tell it for us.
Yes.
People like the people that were in that meeting, you know what I mean? And they don't care because they don't even know what happened to our people. You know, like my grandmother had to choose Pakistan, even though she was from India, because my paternal grandfather, all of his lands were in the Pakistan side. So she had to leave with literally no promise or any awareness of whether or not she would be able to go back to her homeland. And she's just one millions of people. We live in a time right now as a first generation Pakistani Latina American, I can't go to India, which is technically the birthplace of my family. You know, how much have I done? You know, I'm not even 35 yet, but the amount that I know about Catholics, the amount that I know about American history, the amount that I know about what's happened in this country that I'm not technically a native to, you know, I had to do that. I went to all girls Catholic high school. I went to a Jesuit university, you know, and I did that with a smile on my face, you know? So like, this is not an even playing field.
When you're thinking about the first generation, what is something that would advice that you would give them around like identity, around even relationship to faith that comes up for you?
Main thing that I would want to get across is stay curious. You know, stay curious about what comes up for you based off of an interaction, a conversation. Try not to judge it immediately, but really try to stay curious to understand yourself better. You know, when I talk about that sort of that end goal being connecting to the one and only, connecting to the Almighty, we all hold that within ourselves as well. So in getting to know God, we're getting to know ourselves. And that's a very divine process. It's a very, certainly, like I've said, spiritual process, but it's one that should be handled with care. So I always will say that handle it with the utmost care. I mean, put that fragile sticker on yourself, because you should be handled delicately, you know, and with respect, understanding that we carry so many stories within us, stories that we might not even be aware of. But, you know, this whole process for me has been such a profound blessing, because it's allowed me to even ask my family questions that I ordinarily haven't been able to ask. You know, like I recently talked to my dad about, so when my paternal grandmother did go back to India, when did she go? And he talked to me about, you know, it was a little bit over 20 years afterwards. And he actually went with my grandmother on her first trip back to India. I mean, I wouldn't have known that unless I was in a place where I'm like, I'm really trying to write about this. I'm trying to resurrect these stories. And yeah, like, I would really say, like, don't take this lightly. Like, you, within you, you hold a wealth of knowledge. So stay curious.
This episode was produced by me, Wayu Shamika. Thank you to Simi for openly sharing her experience. I really appreciate it. And we will be back next week for another episode. But until then, be in peace, folks, and see you later.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.